The date is June 11th, 1986, and we're watching Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Hello, and welcome to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. My name is Sean Wells, and with me, as always, is the Cameron to my Ferris.
Hello, I'm Colin Stewart.
And this week, I'm excited we are doing our first ever by request episode. We were contacted on Instagram by a fan of the show, and so, Rebecca, this episode is for you. That kind of makes me feel like at the end in the parade where he says, for Cameron, who thinks he had a bad time today, this one's for you. But Rebecca, this is for you. And because of that, we decided we needed to bring back our John Hughes fangirl, the non-romantic Sloane of our group, because we, you know, I don't want to piss off her fiance. But Carly Holm, welcome back, Carly.
Yay, thank you for having me back. I'm so excited.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this, in case people don't remember, she was in our Planes, Trains, and Automobiles episode, and we did talk about how we were thinking that we needed to watch this movie immediately following that podcast. Did you actually go and watch Ferris Bueller's Day Off that night?
Not that night, but within a couple of days, yeah, I went back on Netflix and I watched it again.
Okay, right on. So this week, we are looking back at June 1986, when the movies and theaters were Big Trouble in Little China, Raw Deal, Space Camp, My Little Pony the Movie, and of course, our movie for today, Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which earned $70.1 million on a $5.8 million budget.
And just a friendly reminder, there will be spoilers ahead, so if by some crazy circumstance that I don't really even want to know about, you have not seen Ferris Bueller in your life, shame on you. But hit pause, go watch it, and then come back and hear what we have to say.
So the tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is, one man's struggle to take it easy.
I mean, I don't know. I like it, but I also hate it.
He never really has much of a struggle, though. He kind of just finds a good time wherever he goes.
Yeah. Well, alternately, I do have a second tagline. While the rest of us were just thinking about it, Ferris borrowed a Ferrari and did it all in one day.
I mean, that accurately sums up the movie. I feel like the first tagline would be if this movie was called Cameron's Day Off.
Yeah.
That
does seem more appropriate. It is, however, not the best description of this movie. That last one did kind of sum it up fairly well, but let's go a bit deeper and get from Colin a 60-second synopsis.
All right, here we go. Ferris Bueller's Day Off is the story of a boy named Ferris who takes a day off from school. After successfully tricking his parents into believing he's sick, Ferris skips school and absconds to downtown Chicago with his best friend Cameron and his girlfriend Sloane for a day of shenanigans and hijinks that could only occur in a 1980s teen comedy. Meanwhile, the dean, Rooney, fed up with Ferris's truant behavior, endeavors to prove he's not actually sick by sneaking around and eventually breaking into the Bueller home. Will Rooney get his man? Will any of the parents realize they've been duped? Was that really Charlie Sheen? Let's find out on another episode of I Used to Like This One.
Right on. So I called you our John Hughes fangirl, Carly.
Mm-hmm.
Refresh our memory. Okay, now Breakfast Club and Ferris Bueller's Day Off are kind of neck and neck for number one John Hughes movies for you, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Without a doubt.
So what is it about Ferris Bueller's Day Off for you?
I think there's a number of things. I think the first thing that really gets me is the nostalgia. Like, that was something that I remember watching with my mom when I was, like, young. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something that really kind of attracts me to that movie as well. And I think it's just the outlandishness of it all. That these things could rarely, if ever, happen. And I think it's also, with that outlandishness, the relatability of it all as well.
Yeah,
because there is, like, it is such a common thing for kids to try and fake, you know, fake sick to play hooky and stuff like that. But then just to see this extraordinary day that happens. It just plays into that, of course, the love of theatrics and stuff that I know all three of us have. But just like that absolute, just extraordinary thing that comes from just everything, you know, kind of just happening. And yeah, everyone wants to be Ferris Bueller. Because he's like, there's something about him that's like, you're like, God, he's such an ass half the time, but he's so cool and so lovable at the same time. And it's, I don't know, also something about a young Matthew Broderick as well. Like, I think that just encapsulates his talent as well.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah, there's so many good things about Ferris Bueller.
You know, while you were talking there about everyone wants that day off from school, I remember a Shel Silverstein poem. And it was something that I performed in elementary school as a spoken word thing. And I put on a wig and everything like that. And it's, I cannot go to school today, said little Peggy Ann McKay. And she goes through, you know, I've got the measles and the mumps, a gash, a rash, and purple bumps. And it goes on and on and on. And then she gets to the end and it's, what's that? What's that you say? You say today is Saturday? Okay. I'm going to go out and play. And, you know, it's just, you know, I think about that fact that, yeah, I've been trying to get those sick days off since grade 5, you know, when when I could relate to this particular poem. What about you, Colin? What kind of history do you have with Ferris Bueller's Day Off?
Not a lot. To be honest, I have only seen it maybe once or twice before this.
Okay.
It's kind of my, like, when I think of John Hughes movies, I immediately run to The Breakfast Club would probably be my go-to. And yeah, Ferris Bueller was the one I came late to, but I remember it more from reference. It's one of those things, I remember it more from references that are made about it than I do from actually watching it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that your go-to John Hughes is The Breakfast Club. I mean, yes, granted, that is one that he directed, but I would have thought that Home Alone would have come out of your mouth, because we've already established that Home Alone is your favorite Christmas movie of all time.
I was going to say, that is true. It would be a toss-up between those two, but for some reason, I don't, even though I know that he wrote it, I don't, for whatever reason, I don't think of it as a John Hughes movie, yeah.
Well, all right, let's jump into Ferris Bueller's Day Off, directed by John Hughes, who we talked about in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, who I was surprised then to find out actually has very few directing credits. Breakfast Club, 16 Candles, Curly Sue, Uncle Buck, Weird Science, and She's Having a Baby. It's also written and produced by John Hughes, and most of the same credits, plus things like Home Alone and Vacation. I discovered that his writing credit for Beethoven, though, is under the name Edmond Dantès, though.
Really?
Yeah, that's one of the ones that is written by him, but he wrote it under a pseudonym for some reason.
Maybe he didn't want to be associated with pet films. He didn't want to be lumped in the same conversation with the writers of, like, MVP, Most Valuable Primate, and Air Bud
series. Yeah. We do have one more producer on this as well, Tom Jacobson, who was a producer on things like Unstoppable, Mission to Mars, Big Trouble, Top Secret, Mighty Joe Young, speaking of another animal movie. And we open on, just kind of like Planes and Trains and Automobiles, not a whole lot, just the sound of a morning weather report and a woman calling Ferris's name. And this is Mrs. Katie Bueller, played by Cindy Pickett, checking on her sick son Ferris, played by Matthew Broderick, who would go on to things like Election, The Producers, Inspector Gadget, the shitty 1998 Godzilla, and Christmas Story Live. And I was interested to find out he played a character called Mr. Buellerton in the movie New Year's Eve. Like, I have seen that movie, like, once. I don't even remember him being in it, but I just found it interesting that his character was Mr. Buellerton in that.
Hmm. Yeah, nice little Easter egg there.
Yeah.
Homage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did read that Rob Lowe, Jim Carrey, Johnny Depp, Tom Cruise, Robert Downey Jr., Michael J. Fox were all possibilities for.
Yeah. I was gonna say when I watched this movie, I'm like, how did Michael J. Fox not get this role? It's clearly written for him. It seems.
Yeah,
like, can you imagine what a Johnny Depp version of this, like Tom Cruise, that would be a very risky business type movie. So yeah, like, I can see him doing this, but Johnny Depp, that would be a very, I don't know, angsty.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the word I was looking for, I think. Yeah.
When did Crybaby come out? I'm just imagining, like,
I think that Crybaby version was like of Johnny 88, 89.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, like, when this one came out, he might have still been on 21 Jump Street. I think 21 Jump Street was, like, 84 to 87, somewhere in there.
Okay.
Yeah. And I love in this scene how Mom has such an 80s power realtor haircut.
Oh. Katie Bueller's style is so good. The shoulder pads with the cardigans, with the belts and the pencil skirts. It's fabulous. Absolute, just amazing style.
Yeah.
Are those called power suits? Is that what those are?
If they've got shoulder pads, they're a power suit. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's like power suits are like the like blazer and matching like pencil skirt duo. Like that's like a power suit.
Yeah.
Nice.
And then Ferris being sick becomes a family affair when Mr. Tom Bueller comes in. He's played by Lyman Ward, who we saw in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. And his sister, Jeannie Bueller, who is played by Jennifer Grey, who is in Red Dawn. She's Baby from Dirty Dancing. And a sitcom I used to watch called It's Like You Know. I remember that show. And that was shortly after she got like her major facial surgery. And she was unrecognizable as Jennifer Grey anymore.
I hate when that happens.
Yeah. There's so many nowadays, like Uma Thurman,
Renee Zellweger.
Yeah.
I was watching When Harry Met Sally a few weeks ago, and I was just lamenting Meg Ryan and all the work that she's had done. Yeah. Like she was just so beautiful.
Yeah, she used to be cute. Cute was the best word. Yeah.
I was wondering, is this movie pre or post Dirty Dancing for Jennifer Grey?
It's pre, because Dirty Dancing is 87. Yeah.
Okay. Because I was watching it, and I was like, it took me a really long time to remember where I remembered her face from. Okay. And then when it finally hit, I was like, I feel like she would have been too famous to do this movie if it was after.
Yeah, Jeannie, of course, doesn't believe Ferris. She says, dry that one out and you can fertilize the lawn. A joke that I probably didn't get the first time I saw this movie, but very funny one.
That's an epic line that I plan to use in my real life.
But man, I love Sick Ferris, like this whole opening scene. And I think one of the most interesting parts of the opening scene is that Ferris's parents were actually married in real life while filming this movie, but they divorced in 1992.
Interesting.
And then Matthew Broderick and Jennifer Grey got engaged shortly after filming this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple years later, they were in like a terrible car accident in Ireland where two people died.
Mm-hmm.
And
what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the mother and the daughter of the oncoming car died because of Matthew Broderick and Jennifer Grey. And then in that 2012, Matthew Broderick was featured in a Honda Super Bowl commercial.
Wow.
Oh, that would be like Jeffrey Jones doing a commercial for like Oshkosh B'gosh or something. We're gonna get to Jeffrey Jones if you don't know about his story, but yeah, he's a bit of a scumbag.
I find it weird when I get it in a movie when people who are like romantic partners, you know, start dating and get married, but I find it a little odd that a brother and sister combination led to a relationship.
So Ferris faking sick, though, is one of the worst performances of his career, but they never doubted it for a second. And how can I possibly be expected to handle school on a day like this? And I love the shot of the windows being thrown open, and it's just blue sky wherever you look.
I wanted to say, with his sick performance, there was an odd point for me when what's the sister's? I just spaced out her name.
Jeannie.
Yeah. When Jeannie comes in and Ferris looks at her and the camera gets blurry.
Yeah.
Like, as if he was actually sick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a weird choice.
Yeah, it's almost like, again, Ferris Bueller being this, like, magnet of a person that, like, even the audience for a second is like, oh, yes, no, he must actually be really, really sick. Like, oh, you know, kind of playing into that influence again.
Yeah. And so we find out that the key to faking out the parents is clammy hands. You fake a stomach cramp, and while you're hunched over moaning and wailing, you lick your palms. Sounds childish, but it works. And I found out that John Hughes, the idea of the words on the screen was not originally in the script. This was just something that he added because he figured it wasn't funny enough without the words. And for me, that moment where he's talking to the camera and the words are up on the screen and we X out the you don't want to end up in a doctor's office. Like, that's always been one of my favorite things about this moment. And I'm glad that it ended up in the movie. And so Ferris is getting ready for his day. He's in the shower. He's actually a good singer. I mean, which we probably know from Matthew Broderick being on Broadway. But it makes it even dumber that later he lip syncs Don Kishane on the float.
I never even put that together. That's a good.
but another thing I don't understand about this is what is the story behind Don Kishane in this movie? Because it's used four separate times.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, I don't know, Ferris has like a weird aesthetic happening. Like, I feel like it's kind of a part of his personality. It's the same way he wears that weird military cap. Like, I don't really understand what that's about either, but I feel like both those things kind of tell me he's...
eccentric?
I'm trying to figure out, like, yeah, like, what kind of group would he belong to in high school? Like, I almost think I don't think he's, like, the popular kid, but I think he's a kid that people like, but he kind of reminds me of, like, a cool... You know who he reminds me of? Joel Sims from our other episodes. You can hear Joel Sims on our Home Alone and...
Coming to America
episodes. But Ferris Bueller is very Joel Sims-esque.
Yeah.
Hopefully he would appreciate me saying that, not be offended, and still come back on our show. So
I'm going to text him after this. Be like, Colin said that you're like Ferris Bueller because you're kind of a weirdo.
But kind of cool. That's the point,
yeah, like
though.
a cool eccentric weirdo. Like, just goes by the beat of his own drum.
Yeah, and has a collection of, like, eccentric, like, sweater vests and stuff.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we cut to Ferris's school, where the hilariously dry Ben Stein, I didn't say Stiller this time, is doing roll call. And he does Adams, Adam Lee, Adamowski, Adamson, Adler, and Anderson. Like, I know it's probably an intentional joke, but what are the odds of six names coming before Bueller?
Yeah.
Like, that has to be pretty low mathematical odds there, right?
Oh, for sure. I mean, working in a school and the amount of attendance sheets that I've seen, there's very few, like, I would say max, like, two or three names that start with A.
Yeah.
Like, probably would not.
What is the most, I was just trying to think, like, what letter has the most names associated to it on average, do you think?
I would say probably S.
S? Okay.
A lot of, like, Smiths or Smithsons or Samuels. Oh, right. Yeah. So S, probably. I if I were to guess, I'd probably say S.
But then it goes from Bueller and jumps directly to Fry. So there's no C, Ds, or E's?
Yeah, I find it really hard to believe there's no Daniels or Davidsons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I do love it because obviously they want to show all the different reactions of the kids, and every one of them is unique and every one of them is hilarious. But it just doesn't seem right, though, that, like, Bueller should have been higher up in the alphabet and there should have been something before Fry.
Yeah.
And I love Ben Stein. Oh, my goodness. Oh. Yeah. And the thing is, like, when you actually listen to what Ben Stein is doing later on when he's teaching the class, all the comedy is with the reactions of the students, because Ben Stein is doing, like, an actual economics lecture. There is nothing funny about what he's doing, except how he's doing it. So character-driven. I love it. But now that he's calling Fry's name, we cut to Cameron's house to meet the man himself, Cameron Fry, who is played by Alan Ruck, who was in Speed, Spin City, Twister, Cheaper by the Dozen, Star Trek Generations. I love his part in Star Trek Generations, because that's the whole opening scene with the original Star Trek guys, and they're on a brand new Enterprise, and everything is coming Tuesday. Like, they're not fully equipped, and he's the captain of that ship. And just like Mr. Buellerton in New Year's Eve, he plays a Dr. Fry in the movie Kicking It Old School. So he's got an homage character in another movie as well.
I watched Kicking It Old School recently. That movie is so bad. I remember my mom for whatever reason bought it for me for Christmas, whatever year it came out. I'd never even heard of it, but I think I love the Jamie Kennedy Experiment.
Yeah.
And so I think she had bought it for me because he was in it. And I remember thinking it was the worst movie I'd ever seen then, which was something, because, I mean, teen comedies when I was in the early 2000s were all pretty terrible.
Yeah.
But Yeah, I saw it was on Amazon Prime a few months back and decided to watch it because I like Michael Rosenbaum, and I was rewatching Smallville, so I wanted to see like what something else he was in. And man, that movie is terrible.
Yeah, because that's the one where he's in a coma and he wakes up, right? And
he still thinks
it's like the 80s.
Yeah, he's a break dancer who falls off the stage and is in coma for like 20 years or something.
Yeah. Yeah, and then Michael Rosenbaum is the asshole new boyfriend or whatever, right? Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I feel like I've seen that recently. I mean, maybe I did the same thing where it was watched it on Amazon Prime or something. Because for me, I was listening to Michael Rosenbaum's podcast a lot.
Yeah.
And it was the same sort of thing as he had mentioned Kicking It Old School. And it's like, oh, yeah, I'll go check that out. But Sorority Boys is almost better.
Yeah, I haven't watched that one. He mentioned it. I listened to that podcast too. He mentioned it so much. I've been meaning to watch it, but I haven't yet.
Yeah. So I did read that Cameron Frye could have been played by Emilio Estevez.
Hmm.
That's fitting because other John Hughes.
Yeah, Breakfast Club. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's always boggled my mind how Cameron's house actually works, though. Okay, so the place where the glass is. That's the garage? Like, the house on stilts, it doesn't look that big. Like, we only ever see it from one angle.
It's not a garage, it's like a showroom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where the Ferrari is. So it's like, I imagine, like, the car sits there, and then his dad, like, just sits in a corner overlooking the ravine with a glass of scotch.
Yeah.
Some nights.
Well, what is his backstory? I mean, you know, like his mother is in Decatur right now. And he says, too bad she's not staying. But, like, I don't even is his father abusive? Like, in the speech he gives later, like, that's the impression that it gives. Mm-hmm. That
yeah.
He's this rage-filled, abusive father.
Yeah. There's definitely a lot of evidence to that, too. Or even just, like, to the point where, again, like, maybe because mom's in Decatur or something, there might have been, like, a divorce or, you know, and kind of just that anger. And that also could kind of explain like Cameron's like being like him being like a hypochondriac and stuff like that, and you know, always thinking that he's sick and stuff like that. So I mean, yeah, maybe it was like an abuse issue or like a divorce.
But he says too bad she's not staying, so it sounds like he's got like disdain for his mother as well.
Yeah, it almost seems like to me the sense that I get is like, yeah, I definitely think based on the conversation later, his dad is abusive, but it's almost like his dad definitely doesn't like him. Yeah. He really just doesn't seem to like his parents at all.
Yeah.
So there's like a bad relationship there.
Yeah. But Ferris has called his hypochondriac friend to get him out of bed and hang out with him for the day. Have you heard the online theory, which is like basically Fight Club? The one where Ferris is actually a figment of Cameron's imagination?
Yes, I have seen that one.
Okay.
That kind of makes sense given that one tagline you read.
Yeah.
It fits, yeah. We then see a phone call to Ferris's mom from Principal Mr. Ed Rooney, who is played by convicted sex offender Jeffrey Jones. You know, it's hard to separate knowing that he's a scumbag now from what he does in this movie, because I do love Mr. Rooney at some point. So just up front, I want to say that I know that he's a creep.
Mm-hmm.
So
what's the story here? I don't know anything about this.
He had child pornography and stuff like that. Yeah.
That's all you need to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he's from Sleepy Hollow, Beetlejuice, Edward, Amadeus, and Howard the Duck. And he's busy telling Mrs. Bueller that Ferris has been absent 9 times when the number starts changing on his computer, and we cut back to Ferris, who is talking about how he asked for a car for his birthday, but he got a computer. What would internet have been like in 1986? I'm thinking non-existent, right?
Yeah, it's pretty close to non-existent, maybe for like the very, very beginning, early stages.
But back when it was still being used by military.
Yeah.
You know, like, how is he hacking into this computer in the school?
He's a cyborg.
I mean, you look at some of the things in this movie, and it could only be made in this little period of time. You know, computers were still a new thing, but people didn't quite understand the technology. But then there also wasn't technology like Star 69 and Star 67, because really, that could have been the easiest way for Ed Rooney to to catch Ferris right in the beginning is just star 6ix9ine his ass, man. Like, so, like, there's this golden period that this movie is set in where computers are in their infancy, but telephone technology isn't quite where it is now. So, but we also, in the scene, get to meet the secretary, Grace, who is played by the fabulous Edie McClurg, with the pencils and sniffing the white out. Oh, she's so funny. The hairdo I read was actually something that Edie McClurg did herself, because the hairdresser on set was mostly hired to do blowouts for Sloan. And so she wasn't really equipped to do this beehive hairstyle. Mm-hmm. So when John Hughes saw it, he asked, how many pencils do you think you can fit in there? So from what I read, the fourth one fell out. But this was a spur-of-the-moment decision to do this pencil gag when he saw the hairdo for the first time.
Nice.
That's amazing.
So we also see at school that Jeannie is getting condolences from people in the hallway. And the lead-in to this scene with the I Dream of Jeannie song, I thought was a brilliant John Hughes moment.
I love the backstory in the school of, like, seeing somebody having seen Ferris faint and it spreading around to everybody. It reminds me so much of in Clerks, like, the girl who died swimming laps at the pool.
Yeah, Julie Dwyer.
Yeah. Yes!
How it, like, spreads across all the films and you get, like, different, like, more context added to it as it goes on.
And we get to see Ferris goofing around, you know, playing that whatever waltz that is, using on his synthesizer with bodily noises. He's on the phone with people at school. I read that synthesizer equipment he has is worth $8,000.
Whoa.
There's your car, Ferris.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Ferris, like, how loaded are the Buellers?
Yeah.
I was watching this movie with my wife, and we were kind of just, like, looking at their house. Mm-hmm. It looks like an estate, for one, and it's in some sort of, like, uppity neighborhood. But then all Ferris's stuff, like, even all the things that he has to, like, create the ruse of him being sick and maintaining it and all that, it's just, like, is this just the rich kid's problem type thing, or?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Like, damn, they really should have just got him a car. He probably would have gotten into, like, way less trouble if they just bought him a car.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and let's bring it back to your question, though, about how cool is Ferris. He's on the phone with all these people pretending to be sick. Aren't they going to be pissed off the next day when they find out that he was at death's door, but, like, they raised money for a fucking kidney? Like, yeah. Like, all the kids think he's a righteous dude, as Grace says later on, but come on, like, this is, you're scamming an entire school, not just a principal at this point.
Yeah.
And then while on the phone with Cameron, Ferris's other line rings, and it's his dad checking up on him. I love the, hello? And then dad's advice is to take a hot bath and wrap a hot towel around your head. Would this be a thing? Or is this just shitty dad advice?
That just sounds like a way to be super warm and uncomfortable. And then, like, you know, it's like one of those things when you are, like, really sick and you get in the shower or something. And then afterwards you feel absolutely terrible because you're overheated and you, like, feel disgusting. Like, that just sounds like, yeah, terrible, terrible, terrible advice.
However, he didn't fake that fever in the beginning. So, you know.
I feel like the dad advice is just that anytime you're sick, you want to sweat stuff out.
Yeah.
Like, you get the toxins out.
Chris Rock's is always, you know, just stick some Robitussin in him. So I guess this is better advice than, hey, just self-medicate. You'll be good. So we see Cameron in his car thinking about leaving, because that's what Ferris Bueller said that he is probably doing right now. And I realized that the Red Wings are, like, my second favorite hockey team. Probably because of this movie, because of Cameron with his Gordie Howe jersey. I always wanted a Gordie Howe jersey. I ended up with an Yzerman jersey, which I think was a decent choice. But yeah, it was him with his Gordie Howe jersey that's why they're my backup team. And then there is the part where Ferris plays the clarinet and says, never had one lesson. Oh, I love it. But I read that this was a spur-of-the-moment decision just because, like, the set decorators had put a clarinet in the background. And Matthew Broderick said, oh, I know how to play a clarinet. But he didn't. So the
amazing.
The joke is just as that Matthew Broderick had is just as good as the Ferris joke here.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we get introduced to Sloane Peterson, who is played by Mia Sara, who is in Legend, Time Cop, and the short-lived Birds of Prey series, where she played Dr. Harleen Quinzel, which is something that I did watch. I watched that series. It lasted like one season. Came out somewhere in that gray area after Smallville ended, before Gotham existed. It was one of those, yeah. I did read that Sloane could have been played by Molly Ringwald, though, but John Hughes said that, no, you know what? It's too small of a part for you. Oh, how snobbish is that?
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fuck you, Mia Sara, is what that says to me.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so when we see Sloane, what's with this classroom? Why is this one a lecture hall when all the other ones that we've seen so far are regular classrooms?
Yeah, like you see that in universities and stuff like that, but never have I once walked into a high school and seen a lecture hall.
Yeah, that's used as a classroom at least.
Yeah.
But the school nurse comes into the classroom, our first person of color in this movie, to tell Sloane some terrible news. And I love how Sloane puts on her jacket and then acts surprised when the nurse comes in and says, you know, Sloane Peterson?
Yeah.
And then meanwhile, in the principal's office, the news of Sloane's dead grandmother is suspicious to Mr. Rooney because she is dating Ferris Bueller. So he asks Grace to get Mr. Peterson's daytime phone number when conveniently Mr. Peterson happens to call. So... Not believing the man on the other end of the phone, he starts being insulting. The whole produce a corpse. You just rolled grandma's bones on in here, and I'll be happy to release Sloane. Oh, I love it. But then Grace answers another phone call. This is when we get the holy shit moment, because Ferris Bueller is on line two, and it gets revealed to us that Cameron is conducting the prank phone call.
I love Cameron's voice that he puts on.
Yeah.
Just the face that he has to make to do it, where he's like, Rooney!
Rooney! Yeah.
Rooney!
Rooney! Ah! God!
But then this is the point where, like, Cameron also, like, drops the ball, like, big time, because he's like, I need you outside with her! Like, and then we get the whole, where is your brain? Why'd you hit me? Where is your brain? Why'd you hit me exchange? How many costume changes does Ferris Bueller have in this movie, though? Because this is the scene where he comes in. Like, they're at Ferris's house right now, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And then he comes in and he's in the full suit. You know, it's like the Rooney, you don't know who you're dealing with. Bueller, Ferris Bueller. But before this, like, he was out sunbathing at one point, and then he was in his t-shirt, and now he's in this. And then later on, he's in the leopard vest. Like, why does he keep changing clothes?
Because he gives us Joel Sims energy.
And so now they have added the complication of Mr. Rooney when they go to spring Sloane from her prison, and they can't pick her up in Cameron's piece of shit car. The solution, we'll just take Cameron's dad's car, a car he loves more than life itself, a 1961 Ferrari 250 GT California. And I can't think of a better place to insert sponsorship corner. So always on the lookout for product placements in movies, Ferris Bueller's Day Off is brought to you by the 1961 Ferrari 250 CT California, Jaguar, Chrysler, Chevy, and Audi, Nike, Carver Electronics, Vicks VapoRub, Dr. Titchener Antiseptic, Tums, Walgreens, 7-Up and Pepsi, Cobra Answering Machines, Miller Lite and Budweiser, Oakland A's, Chicago Cubs, and Detroit Red Wings, Maxwell Tapes, Webster's New World Compact Dictionary, MTV, the band's Killing Joke and Simple Plan, the arcade game Karate Champ, Newtone Doorbells, the Chicago Sun-Times, Sony, Oreo, Cartier, Dead Pereira Currency Exchange. I'm wondering whether that's a typo. Did autocorrect screw me on that one? I don't know. That doesn't sound right. J-Mar, Sansabelt, the Slack Shop. That was one of my favorite ones. J-Mar, Sansabelt, the Slack Shop. Shaky Restaurant, and Warm Pocket Gummy Bears. And this has been Sponsorship Corner.
There must be two bands called Simple Plan, right? Like,
that can't be like the Canadian... Simple Plan.
No, that's 1989.
Yeah, those are the ones that sing "Don't You Forget About Me."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's actually kind of a little nod to Breakfast Club.
Ah.
Oh wait, Simple Minds. Oh, not Simple Plan. Nope, it's not two bands named Simple Plan. Simple Minds.
Yeah.
Is the ones that sang "Don't You Forget About Me." Oh, I'm so stupid. So now that they're at the garage here, I've never understood the transition of the scene. When Ferris said that he needed a favor back at his house, what did Cameron think they were going back to Cameron's house for? Did they just drive in silence all the way to Cameron's house for him to be like, okay, we're here to take your dad's car?
I don't feel like Cameron does much thinking, to be honest. Yeah. I think Cameron is just kind of like along for the ride. Mm-hmm. And he's just like, this is kind of like where the Fight Club theory, I think, there is some credence to it, because he's just like kind of swept along, doing whatever Ferris wants to do, because that's like the quote-unquote right thing to do, is to live your life in freedom and bliss or whatever, but...
Yeah, and that could explain why Tom and Katie Beeler are like such loving parents, is if he's escaping from the reality of his abusive parents...
Yeah.
Well, I was trying to think, like, really the only hole in the Fight Club theory to me is the fact that you see them with Sloane together. Because in Fight Club, the crazy thing that you don't realize until the end is that, like, they're never with Marla
at the same time.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, that she's kind of the connector between the two.
True. And, of course, for anyone worried about this sexy Ferrari, it isn't actually a Ferrari, I found out.
Really?
Yeah, it's a replica, kind of like the Mustang in Gone in 60 Seconds. Would have cost too much to wreck an actual Ferrari. So, we go back to Mr. Rooney, who is going to get Sloane, and I enjoy the bit with, like, Mr. Rooney running down the hall, but then casually walking past every classroom. I used to do this in school. Mm-hmm. And I also love the line where he and Sloane are on the front steps, and she says, "Well, I guess that's my dad," when they actually show up. It's like, way to keep it cool, Sloane.
Yeah.
I guess that's my dad. And then, of course, Ferris and Sloane kiss. So that's how it is in their family. Okay. And so, like, between this kiss and the scream when they take off, because she's all, woo, when they peel out of the parking lot, like, they're just not good at covering their tracks, or do they just not give a shit at this point?
I just don't think they care.
Yeah?
Yeah, that there's that bout of arrogance, especially with Ferris. It's like, yeah, I don't care. Like, you know, we're kind of home free right now. What are they going to do? They're going to get in the car and chase after us, or what? Yeah. Like, so I definitely think, yeah, at that point, it's like, no, they don't even really care.
Yeah. So they get to downtown Chicago, and they leave their car in a parking garage, and he says, "Will you relax? I'm going to give the guy a 5 to watch it." Nice bribery, Ferris. But man, this guy is such a creepy dude. Like,
well, I was scared of him when I was younger. Like, the guy freaked me out.
He's got Jesus from The Big Lebowski vibes to him, like with his creep factor. And I did read, though, that this part was originally offered to Bill Paxton, who has the weird science connection with John Hughes, but he turned it down because it was a small part, but he says he regrets the choice. But then this creepy attendant guy ends up taking off with his buddy to go for a joyride, and they squeal out of there. And, you know, of course, the only other person of color we've seen so far in this movie is playing a degenerate. John Hughes really needed more minorities in his films, especially since you're in Chicago. You're in Chicago! So we get a scene where Mom has come home to check on Ferris, and she sees him roll over in bed, but she thinks about the 9 times that Mr. Rooney said. I love the contraption that he has set up, though. Like, what a feat of engineering.
Genius, yeah. That's like, it's like one of those things where Ferris is like an evil genius. Like, he's definitely smart. And again, maybe it's my teacher coming out. It's like, if you only applied that to like the places that were important, like, oh, he would be such a successful person, because he's so smart and just creative that those things go off without a hitch.
Yeah.
It's craziness.
It's funny to see some of the parallels in like John Hughes movies when I was watching this one. Probably because we just watched Home Alone, but I was like, oh, it is very, like, Obviously, he's not creating like a giant death trap, but I mean,
is that same
type of ingenuity and these weird family, like contraptions to just like fool people.
Yeah. Now comes the point of the movie where time seems irrelevant, because first they go to the Sears Tower. It is interesting that to find out in this movie that the Sears Tower is the world's tallest building, that Ferris says. It's 1,353 feet, and that is definitely not true anymore. Like, I don't think the Sears Tower is even in the top five anymore.
No.
And then they go to the stock exchange, and the room they go into looks kind of like the Duke Brothers, what the Duke Brothers had in Trading Places. Like, why is this group of teenagers allowed to be in there?
And also, why would they want to go there? Like, what is the interest?
Yeah. Back in our Trading Places episode, I know I mentioned that I was always fascinated with the idea of a stock floor. Maybe this is why.
Yeah.
But it just... whatever. Yeah, you're right. Why would they want to? This is how you're spending your day off. You were sunning yourself in the backyard at one point, and this is what you want to do for your day is, okay, let's go watch stocks happen.
I know, honestly, I was thinking about this. If it was Colin's day off, I think I would have just... Rooney would have caught me because I would have just been hanging in my house, reading a book, alone. Yeah. That's my ideal day off.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, and just then pretend to be sick anyways and sleep all day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they go for lunch at Shea Key. It's hilarious that Ferris tries to bribe him with a $1 bill. I actually paused and rewound that. I'm like, how much is he trying to slip him? So, like, first the parking attendants get a $5, and then this guy gets, like, a crumpled up $1. Mm-hmm. And then later on, you see that Ferris, like, pulls this huge wad of cash out of his pocket. Okay, there's your car, Ferris. But, but he bribes this guy with a $1. But, yeah, he's pretending to be Abe Froman, the Sausage King of Chicago. And this guy doesn't believe him, the maitre d', and so he says, A, you can never go too far. B, if I'm going to get busted, it's not going to be from a guy like that. And so they pull another bit of a prank so that they can get themselves this table. Star 69 would have solved a bunch of problems. And that's the older technology. But how come the real Abe Froman doesn't ever show up?
Yeah. Were they just incredibly lucky? And again, Ferris has some like voodoo powers and picks somebody who's mysteriously gonna no-show, or?
Yeah, because there you never see the scene where the maitre d' is at the front going, no, I'm Abe Froman. So we get a description of Cameron's house being very nice and very cold, and you're not allowed to touch anything. It's like a museum. So, you know, Ferris is kind of planting the seeds that Cameron's the one that needs this day off, which goes back to Colin's earlier comment about this should be Cameron's day off. But he also says, I'm actually surprised that I got the car out of the garage. It really didn't seem like it was that tough in the scene when it happened, though.
Mm-hmm.
Cameron really didn't put up a fight.
Yeah, I think Cameron's secretly a little bit of a masochist, and he's, again, it might go back to him being, you know, a child of divorce or abuse or something. And it's kind of that like final thing of like, fuck it, I don't care anymore. Let's just do it, do something to get a rise out of someone. But I think again, and maybe it is going back to, again, the Fight Club theory, but I think it is part of him that wants to just like, no, let's be, whether or not it's a figment of our imagination or not, but let's be like Ferris, even if it is just for a day.
Do you think there is actually something wrong with Cameron though? Maybe not like physical health wise, but like this guy must have some major depression issues, right?
I think so. Yeah. Depression or anxiety. I think definitely like either I get senses of either like OCD with like his hypochondria and stuff like that. But I would say, yeah, definitely depression for sure. And some anxiety when he goes catatonic and stuff like that. So definitely some mental issues for sure.
Yeah. So, meanwhile, Mr. Rooney has left the school to do some investigating. I love his introduction, though, with the jazzy music, where he pulls up on the street and he flips up his glasses.
Oh, it's so good.
Beautiful. I love it, yeah. But then, given what we know about Jeffrey Jones, when he gets into the arcade and says the line, "Your ass is mine," to a teenage girl, seems a little rocky in retrospect.
Didn't age well.
That girl looks nothing like Ferris from behind. Like,
It's the same jacket, though. That's a very obvious jacket. Like, the cow print type leather that he has going on.
Yeah.
But she spits milkshake at him, and he goes over to the counter to clean up. And then a joke that I've never noticed before is when he asks, who's winning? And the guy says, the Bears. But it's a baseball game. And so I've never noticed that joke before this time. So I'm glad I found a new joke in a movie I've seen 100 times.
Oh, yeah. I didn't get that until just now because the Bears are the football team.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So it was the Cubs versus the Braves. This was an actual game that took place in June 5th, 1985, and it was the Cubs versus the Braves. But, yeah, when he's looking away from the screen, we see Ferris on screen having just caught a foul ball. So now this is where the time really fucks with my head. After spending all that time in the morning where he was sunbathing and practicing clarinet and convincing Cameron to go out, and then the Sears Tower, Stock Exchange, lunch, and now a baseball game, how is this even possible? They still have the museum trip and the parade to go. Like, did they stay for, like, one inning?
Yeah, I was gonna say, they went for, like, an inning, and then they had, like, I mean, that's really the only place where they could cut time, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, he played clarinet for a total of 2 minutes, and then he was done.
Yeah.
All of that stuff in the morning happened for about 5 minutes at a time.
Well, and he went to all that trouble of, like, the sunbathing. Like, he had a drink with an umbrella beside him. Mm-hmm. Like, he was out there. Didn't he have the mirror around his neck and everything?
To get the under the
chin? Like, I don't know. So we've got Rooney goes by Ferris's house. And so this is one of those instances where we hear Donkashane because Rooney starts humming Donkashane. Like, I just, it's like, what is the significance of this song in this movie? Because Jeannie sings it at one point as well.
Yeah.
So how much of this stuff does Ferris already have set up? Like the doorbell recording or the sound effects, the whole pulley system to roll over the dummy in bed. Like, does he already have the hooks in the wall? Like, how much planning? Have any of his other 8 absences been this elaborate that he already has these things in place?
I think in one of the beginning shots, like in the very beginning of the movie, when they're showing stills of like his room,
yeah.
I think you can see hooks and stuff in there. I think you can either that, or it's like, it's hooks like where his curtains or something are.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think I saw hooks in like those beginning stills.
Well, we got Rooney trying to look around the house. I have to say, I don't even understand what Mr. Rooney is looking for by poking around the Bueller home anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not a doctor. He's not coming at him with a thermometer.
Yeah.
If Ferris is home, he's just going to pretend he's sick anyway. So, really, what's the point?
Yeah.
But anyway, he's poking around, and thing with his shoe in the mud, it's still very funny to me, but I noticed for the first time ever that when he bends over, his pants split as well.
Yeah.
I've never noticed that before. Maybe I'm just never been looking at Jeffrey Jones's ass before, but
yeah,
this time I noticed it. But the other thing I noticed about this scene is John Hughes really likes scenarios that involve a dog door, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And we get a quick scene of the Star Wars theme playing while the joyride in the Ferrari happens. And then we cut to the museum scene. And it seems odd that someone would let these 3 grown people be part of the chain with the little kids walking through the museum.
Yeah.
That seems like some poor teacher work, some poor supervisor work on the part of those, whoever was in charge of this field trip.
As a child, if some random grown person grabbed my hand, like, you best believe I'd be screaming or like, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, isn't this like this was like the time of like Stranger Danger and all that, was it not?
I think so. Should have been.
Yeah.
So then we get the weird montage. This is the one scene in the movie that I've never really been a fan of or really understood. This whole montage in the art gallery is just weird. They've got the passionate kiss in front of the stained glass window, and Cameron's staring at the art. Like, he's staring at it like it's one of those magic 3D eye puzzles that used to be in the middle of malls back in the 90s. Like, that's how he's staring at this thing. Like, he's just, I don't understand. Like, is there symbolism happening in this scene?
Yeah, I didn't get it.
Yeah.
I was like, is the picture stained or something?
Yeah.
I didn't understand what was happening there.
It's like zooming in on the eyes of the eye. Yeah, I just...
Yeah, it was something that... It took me a while to kind of wrap my head around. I still don't understand a lot of it, but I think the thing with Cameron looking at that piece of art and all like the pointillism and stuff like that, I think it's supposed to symbolize how hyper fixated he gets on like the teeniest, tiniest little things, yeah. Or even just like his feeling of being so minuscule and like part of this like huge thing that is Ferris Bueller, but he feels just like so tiny and small and unimportant.
So maybe Cameron's actually on the spectrum a little bit.
I wouldn't be surprised. I actually like that. I think that would be a fair assumption to make, or even like hypothesis.
Yeah. And then again, with the time question, how much time did they spend in this museum? Because there's enough time for them. Like, I've heard that the Louvre in Paris is one that you can't get through unless you spend like 2 solid weeks in that to properly get through that museum. How big is the Chicago Art Institute? Like, you'd have to spend at least a couple hours there, or did they just race through, do their little poses, and that's it? Like, how much?
Yeah.
The time doesn't make sense because now it's parade time. There's a lot going on in this city today in the middle of the afternoon on a weekday.
Yeah.
Like a parade and a baseball game. I did read that the original cut of this movie was 2 hours and 45 minutes. Like, it makes me wonder how expanded some of these scenes were.
Oh my God. For taking that long.
It also apparently only took 6 days to write this movie. And on this viewing, there's some cases where I kind of see that, yeah, it probably only took 6 days to write this movie.
Yeah.
Definitely. The story is so simple, and most of the movie is just people going places. Like,
yeah.
And looking for things and doing stuff. Like, there's not actually a lot of dialogue in the movie.
And a lot of it is just these, like, breaking the fourth wall with Ferris explaining things to the camera. That's what most of it is these Ferris Bueller soliloquies, you know? And so they get in the cab. Ferris is trying to convince Cameron what a great day they're having. We ate pancreas today, Cameron. But then they spot Ferris's dad in the cab next to them. Okay, first of all, why is Ferris's dad just in cabs all day long? Like, they left lunch 2 hours. Well, who knows? Like, they've been to a baseball game. They've been to the museum. What does Ferris's dad do that he's just able to sit in cabs all day long? But I love the line from Sloane where she said, you know, they say, what's he doing now? And she says, he's licking the glass and making obscene gestures with his hands.
It made me uncomfortable when Sloane was like blowing kisses
at
Ferris's dad, and like,
and I don't know. I mean, good on them for not having Ferris's dad like take the bait. That would have been even more awkward, but
yeah, it was a very... she's the youngest of these two main actors, and she's playing the youngest character as well because she's still got 1 year left in high school. So she's supposed to be 17, but the actress was actually 18. Whereas Matthew Broderick was like 23 or 24, and Alan Ruck was 29. So yes, you're right. It would have been extra awkward considering she was playing 17, and she was also only 18. But we see his dad reading a paper, and there's an article on the front of this paper about the community rallying over a sick kid. How is there already an article in this paper? Like, I guess back in the day, there used to be a morning edition and an evening edition, but this seems too late, or sorry, too early for the evening edition. Like,
it's just hot off the presses.
Yeah.
That's why he's in a cab. He had to run down to the actual printing press to get himself one of the first copies. Yeah, okay.
My beef with that scene, too, is like, maybe it's like Sloane and Ferris haven't been dating for that long, but like, how do you not know what your son's girlfriend looks like? I don't know. That's like my big thing. And I know, of course, they play, oh, she's got a disguise.
She has sunglasses. Yeah.
Well, if it works for Superman.
There you go. Yeah. And his aren't tinted. So, you know.
Okay. Yeah. Touche. But that was like always my thing. I'm like, how does he not recognize her? Because like, that's his son's girlfriend.
Yeah. So we get into the parade scene, and Ferris has abandoned Sloane and Cameron. And then we find out that Ferris has commandeered, what is that float? Is it like, it's German something, maybe? Like, everyone's dressed in German or Swiss type outfits.
It's Oktoberfest.
Yeah, that's kind of what it looks like. But this is supposed to be taking place in the spring or something like that. But I do kind of find it hard to believe that Twist and Shout being lip-synced by some guy on a float would just completely fucking bring the house down.
Like, yeah.
Everyone goes ape shit.
Yeah.
And I'm a huge Beatles fan, and even I'd be like, oh, cool, catch a show. That's fine.
Yeah. Were they like, man, that guy really sounds like Paul McCartney or whoever.
that one's a Lennon. That one's a Lennon. Yeah. But I mean, like, yeah, I like the song, but for it to completely close down the street, like, what the fuck is going on at this point? Where are the barricades?
Yeah. Like, the thing is, that song was going to be playing regardless if Ferris was there or not, right?
So, like,
was that going to happen anyways?
Maybe. Just,
Chicago is just so down for the Beatles.
Everyone was just so shocked that it was coming from the Oktoberfest float. They're like, wait, this isn't right. That's not Oompa-pa. That's the Beatles. What's going on? I have to get in closer to find out. And as if something like this wouldn't end up in tomorrow's paper. Yeah. So I read that this was filmed over two different Saturdays, and one was an actual parade that was happening, and that's where most of the long shots came from. But Matthew Broderick was still out there performing on the float. And then the second weekend was when they did the packed crowd stuff, and they advertised in the paper for people to come and be in a John Hughes movie. So some of these people were just regular guys, like the window washer and the construction guys. They were just guys that were out there dancing along, and it's like, okay, get a camera on them. And so it's like, yeah, that's how you get in a John Hughes movie, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, that would be just like, imagine going and not thinking anything of it. You're like, okay, I was an extra in that, or I just went and saw a parade, and then you go see the movie, and there you are, like, as like a close shot of you dancing in a parade, and that it's in a John Hughes movie. I'd lose my mind.
Yeah. And it's impressive that that one dance company that comes out onto the steps has such a well-choreographed routine that involved those stairs. I mean, it makes it fun, but it's like, come on, come on. Like, it's Twist and Shout. Like, so now I realize that I haven't talked about Genie a whole lot, but I must say that the Genie storyline on this watch for me is so pointless. Like, in the beginning, he's winking at her, so she knew he was faking it, but all day long, she's just been getting pissed off. And then she comes home, runs upstairs, kicks open the door, and says, I knew it! You already fucking knew it, Genie! What?
Yeah.
The whole Genie stuff is just like,
Even the end, when she comes to Ferris's rescue, doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Given how angry she's been all day, like, there's no...
Yeah.
And given the fact that she just tried to race him in a car back home.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, how... there needs some arc there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of, like, why she changed her mind.
But she's just so angry. And then she hears Rooney come in, and we get silence. I love this scene. Like Jennifer Grey really moves like a dancer in this scene, but I love the silence of her, like, sneaking down the hallway and everything. But she kicks Rooney in the face. How does she not recognize Rooney as she's kicking him in the face?
Do they not go to the same school?
Yeah, they do. Because she goes into the principal's office to talk to Mr. Rooney, and that's when Grace tells her, oh, she's out on school business.
She's on personal business. Right,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't get that. It's personal and none of your business.
Yeah, because, like, I know it would still be a shock, but once you had kicked him, you'd think she would know who it was. Like,
yeah, be like, oh my god, so sorry, like, are you okay?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But she calls down on the intercom and says that she has her father's gun and a scorching case of herpes, so Rooney gets out of there, and I find that it's an impressive amount of parking tickets that Mr. Rooney has managed to collect on his windshield in suburban Chicago.
Yeah.
In such a short amount of time. Like, yes, you were in front of a fire hydrant, but he's got like 12 tickets on there. Like,
they come back every hour on the hour, every half hour.
The amount of time that he's been there, it seems like the every 5 minutes on the 5 minutes. Like,
yeah.
So, yeah, Ferris and his squad, their day is coming to a close. They got to get home. So they're driving home from downtown, and Ferris sees the odometer and mentally does some math that doesn't add up and says, here's where Cameron goes berserk. What I don't understand is, in this case, what's the difference between 150 miles put on a car and the 15 miles they would have put on it anyway? Like, if his dad knows the mileage, he'd still notice the mileage change, whether it's 1 or 50.
Yeah.
And so we also get a cut back to the house where Jeannie answers the door when it rings because she thinks it's the cops. And we get the, I heard that you were feeling ill, headache, fever, and a chill. I came to help restore your pluck because I'm the nurse who likes to. What's the end of the sentence? Because there are two possibilities.
I think it's fuck.
Okay. So to make Ferris feel better, they rented him a hooker.
You know what? There's some holes in this story, but I...
It was a different time.
I wouldn't put it past them, like, especially because they are seniors, to, oh, this is going to cheer them up, you know? Yeah.
So with Cameron all catatonic, they go sit in a hot tub for a while. Whose hot tub is this? Is this Cameron's house, or have they just broken into some guy's backyard to use his pool and hot tub?
Yeah.
I feel like it's Cameron's house.
Maybe. Okay.
I don't know.
Or could it be Sloane's house?
Maybe.
I don't know. I don't even know whose house it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Of course, if it was Sloane's house, she probably wouldn't have changed in front of Cameron earlier.
Yeah. I mean,
she's not even wearing a bathing suit. She's in, like, a negligee.
Yeah.
So we end up at the police station with, I guess, Jeannie has been arrested, and I still love that Charlie Sheen is there for drugs.
Glimpse it just of the all future.
Comes for full circle, doesn't it?
Yeah. I read that he stayed up for 48 hours before filming the scene, though, to get that wasted look.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And there was a major backstory for this character, too. His name was Garth, and the house that Mrs. Bueller was showing was his house. There was a huge thing with this.
Nice.
But he, I love that Charlie Sheen is the sane one. He asks Jeannie, what do you care if your brother ditches? So go figure. Drugged out Charlie Sheen is the sane one.
Never thought I'd heard that be said.
So we get a scene now where Sloane and Cameron are talking. This is while they're trying to take the miles off the car by going in reverse. And Cameron is coyly trying to pretend like he didn't see Sloane changing. And in this moment, I looked at him and I'm like, oh my God, he looks just like Ed Helms in this moment.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay, it wasn't just me. Yeah.
Anyway. Mm-hmm.
So, but we find out that, go figure, the miles aren't coming off the car by going in reverse. And then we get the big dramatic Cameron Fry speech of he's got to take a stand. You know, who do you love? You love a goddamn car. And he's beating the car up. I'm just tired of being afraid. And so this is where it's like, what is his story?
Yeah.
But then he kicks it one too many times. It goes out the window and crashes into the valley that's behind the house. What did I do? You killed the car. And Ferris actually steps up for a moment, though, and decides that he's going to take the heat on this. And Cameron decides, no, he wants the heat.
Yeah, that scene for me felt like it just sunk like a Cameron into a pool.
Yeah.
Because there was no groundwork laid before. We know nothing about, like, we've speculated this entire show about, like, what Cameron's backstory is, but...
Yeah, there's bits and pieces dropped every once in a while.
There just wasn't enough to, like, give you any real insight into what is actually happening with Cameron to make that scene really pay off for me.
But is it maybe brilliant, though, of John Hughes that he's dropping you into this life and you're just supposed to put the pieces together yourself? I mean...
No.
Okay.
That's not how stories work. that's not how movies work.
I read that they filmed this crash scene in the fall, but it wasn't supposed to be fall in the timeline, so they actually had to hand paint the leaves on the tree green.
Oh my God. Wow.
But if you look carefully in the reflection of, like, one of the glasses from the outside, you can see that one of the trees wasn't painted because it wasn't in the shot. But it was in the reflection. Yeah. It's just like Alice in Wonderland painting the roses red. You know?
Yeah.
I would have hated to be the person who got that job.
Yeah, imagine being set. Okay, you're going to paint all these leaves today. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Yeah, go for a career in show business, they said.
My mother will be so proud.
Yeah. So we go back to the police station where we get a little bit more diversity dropped in. We get the Asian detective and Jeannie making out with Charlie Sheen. He asks her what her name is and she says it's Jean, but a lot of guys call me Shauna.
What the fuck?
What's that leap of logic? Yeah.
I don't know. I remember always loving that though, especially like the Shauna. Because yeah. my mom's name is Shauna, so I always like, especially watching that with her, oh my gosh, that's my mom's name. But yeah, that does not make any sense.
It's like there's an episode of How I Met Your Mother where they mentioned Edmonton. And I'm like, ah, they said the place I'm from. Yeah, it's I always love that in movies.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then this is the part where Jeannie sings Don Shane. I don't get it. I don't get it. And so we cut back to Sloane and Ferris, and she says to Ferris, you knew what you were doing when you woke up this morning, didn't you? Well, it feels like Sloane must have too, though, because she had to make an answering machine message. Or did they do that after they left the school? Because then it's like the time questions get even more confusing.
Yeah.
And she was putting on her jacket. She knew she was leaving the school.
Yeah.
So of course he knew what he was doing this morning when he woke up, because you must have too, Sloane. Now it's the time where what we mentioned earlier, where Jeannie has to race Ferris home. But why is Jeannie the one driving home from the police station? They're in mom's car. Jeannie's in trouble. Why is mom letting Jeannie drive?
If I picked my child up from the police station after her being arrested, I'd be like, maybe not the wisest choice for you to get behind the wheel of a car, especially my car. Yeah, that doesn't make sense.
Maybe as punishment for Jeannie being arrested, the mom decided that Jeannie had to be her servant.
We're playing sitcom rules now.
Yeah.
And so therefore,
she became her butler/driver for the next week.
Oh my God.
So yes, Ferris now has to race Jeannie home, and we find out that even for saving Cameron's life, he's still a sleazebag, because first he steals a barbecuer's Pepsi as he runs by, and then he hits on those two bikini-clad girls just after telling his girlfriend that he loves her.
Yeah.
Yes.
Toxic masculinity is what that is.
I mean, it's a funny moment when he stops and, hi, Ferris Bueller. But the sickness is so legendary at this point, though, that you'd think they would be like, wait a minute, the Ferris Bueller? As in, save Ferris on the water tower, Ferris Bueller?
Yeah.
It can't be a very common name in suburban Chicago. But and then I realized in this scene just how dim-witted Ferris's dad is. Like, just strangely dim-witted. Like, when he's getting the mints out of the glove compartment, and then he almost hits the guy coming through the stop sign. And then there's the whole bit where he passes the little old lady that, first of all, is swerving all the way across the fucking road, but he passes her on a residential street. That's not how you drive.
That's not legal.
So, everybody's license plates, though, have you ever noticed that they're all John Hughes movie Easter eggs?
Really?
Yeah, no. Katie's license plate is VCTN, which is for vacation. Jeannie's is TBC for the Breakfast Club. Tom's is MMOM for Mr. Mom. And Rooney's is 4FBDO for Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Hmm.
Like, the only exception is Cameron's dad, which is the nervous.
That's so cool. I didn't notice that before.
Yeah. So when all the parents get home, mom tells dad that Jeannie got 2 speeding tickets. How did Jeannie get 2 speeding tickets? Like, you mean to tell me that they've already dealt with the police twice and still beat Ferris home, who's doing all these like backyard shortcuts?
Yeah.
And then they walk into the house. How did all those flowers and balloons and everything get inside the house between the time that Jeannie was arrested?
I was trying to remember. Are they there? Are they there when Jeannie comes in? Like when she figures out? Well,
oh, when she storms in the house?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know.
I don't remember either.
Even then, how did they get in the house?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like, Mr. Rooney is handed the one plant while he's standing on the steps, but he didn't put everything in the house. While I'm sneaking around this house and to check on whether this kid is actually faking sick, I'm just going to bring everything in for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and then Ferris gets caught by Rooney on the back step, and this is, that batshit crazy Jeannie has a change of heart, where she comes out and says, can you imagine someone as sick as Ferris trying to walk home from the hospital? Oh, thank you for driving him home, Mr. Rooney. And then the tag of, "And Mr. Rooney, you left your wallet on the kitchen floor." And she throws the wallet aside and the dog attacks him and everything like that. And somehow Ferris manages to make it upstairs just in time, uses the baseball in his pocket to throw at his $8,000 synthesizer.
Turn off the snoring.
Just in time for Mom and Dad to come into the room. And man, he got away with it. But life moves pretty fast, and if you don't stop to look around once in a while, you could miss it. And then we get the final little scene here where Rooney is offered a ride on the school bus, and he is told, "I bet you never smelled a real school bus before." But the funny thing is, this scene was originally supposed to appear earlier in the cut, which is why there's kids busing home from school at 6 p.m. So in case you've ever wondered why it was supposed to happen when Jeannie says that the cops are on their way and this is where he's supposed to take refuge.
Oh, but really? Yeah,
the fact that kids are busing home at 6 o'clock. This is why is the scene wasn't supposed to be here.
Hmm.
And he gets the gummy bear that's real soft because it's been in her pocket all day. And so it's real soft. And warm.
It's like, I had students the other day. They brought like a whole big bag of mini eggs. And one of them comes with me, "Do you want a mini egg?" And it's just like in their hand. I'm like, absolutely no, I don't want your hand mini egg. No.
Little kids are so bad for that. I remember when I was in China, I was at this like, I don't remember, it was like we were doing this like kids camp and they'd have like their little cereal or whatever in the morning. And later in the day, these kids would come up to me with their like a handful of like the nastiest, like, crusty hand cereal, and like try to give it to me, like, so nice, and I'd have to, like, take it, and I'd be like, "Oh, thank you," and I'd just be like, "Yeah, I'll eat it later."
Wow, nice.
Yeah, this is like my girlfriend always has pocket mints. That's one of her favorite things to have, is pocket mint, because she doesn't really carry around purses very often, so yeah, it's pocket mint. And then, of course, because it's Ferris Bueller's day off, we do get the post-credits scene of the "You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go." And the end. And that is Ferris Bueller's day off.
I have a little bit of payback before we leave.
Oh, okay.
So remember how you both sprung a script on me to read for Planes, Trains, and Automobiles?
Yeah.
So I sent you both. I couldn't download it, unfortunately, because it was the whole script. But I know we mentioned our righteous dude a few times today.
Yeah.
So I sent you both the script for that scene between Grace and Rumi.
Okay.
If you would be so kind to give us a beautiful cold read.
Okay.
Alrighty. So you want me and Colin to do it then? Okay. Okay.
I feel like mine are out of... Oh, wait. Okay,
Reason, one of them got sent twice.
Yeah, sorry, that might have been my bad.
Oh, no, I got, there's five, right?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Okay, I'm good.
Who am I? Who are you?
Okay, I'll be Rooney.
You'll be Rooney? Okay.
I feel like Sean has grace within him.
Oh, do I?
Let's see. I've got to muster up my grumpiest. My grumpiest voice. I was thinking I could do the Cameron's Sloan's dad. Rooney, I don't trust this Rooney. Kid any further than I can throw him. Okay, here we go. I don't trust this kid any further than I can throw him.
Well, with your bad knee, Ed, you shouldn't throw anyone.
It's true. What is so dangerous about a character like Ferris Bueller is, he gives good kids bad ideas. The last thing I need at this point in my career is 1,500 Ferris Bueller disciples running around these halls. He jeopardizes my ability to effectively govern the student body.
Well, makes you look like an ass is what he does, Ed.
Thank you, Grace. I think you're wrong.
Well, he's very popular, Ed. The sportos, the motorheads, geeks, sluts, bloods, wastoids, dweebies, dickheads, they all adore him. They think he's a righteous dude.
That is why I have got to catch him this time. To show these kids that the example he sets is a first-class ticket to nowhere.
Ooh, Ed, you sounded like Dirty Harry just then.
Really? Thanks, Grace.
Yes.
Yay.
I used to like this One Piece theater.
It was great.
Right on.
Johnny, you have beautiful grace.
So now Colin, Carly. On IMDb, it scored a 7.8 out of 10 and has a Metascore of 61. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has 79% on the tomato meter and an audience rating of 92%. But Colin, those are just numbers. Like Genie kicking an intruder in the face. Hit us with some reviews.
All right. Google user Tahitian Flowers says, 5 out of 5 stars, just an all-time classic. If Ferris Bueller were a high school student today, he would still be cool. Glad to see a movie that proves that some things don't change, like your younger siblings annoyingly getting away with everything, and you hate them for it, but when worse comes to worse, you still team up when it comes to family. Love this movie.
It's funny because, like, even just hearing you say it again there about how cool Ferris is, and we had this debate a little bit earlier, the Breakfast Club is a movie that's so much about cliques. You're the jock, you're the spaz, you're the nerd. And it really does make you wonder, where does Ferris Bueller fall in? Like, what clique is he part of? Yeah, is he just that cool floater that everyone likes for some reason?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you know, like, that is what Grace says. They all think he's a righteous dude. And I don't get the appeal. He seems like a peer-pressuring jerk, you know?
All right, next we have Rotten Tomatoes user Ryan C., who gave the movie 5 out of 5 stars. He says, perfection within its era, inventive, hilarious, wrapping bold weirdness in unassuming veneer of mundanity. Every scene, exemplary. Every song, delightful. Every line, quotable. My favorite.
Okay.
And then this last one I picked pretty much because it kind of sums up my thoughts on the movie. It's from SCGS. 3.5 out of 5 stars. He says, a short, innocent, and clever comedy that still works even if you're seeing it for the first time in 2020. Memorable scenes, clever comedy, good acting. This can be recommended for when you don't know what to watch but want to make sure it won't let you down.
That's fair.
Yeah, that is really fair. I like that. Because that is so true. It's something that, like, you can watch over and over again and not be disappointed with it. But I guess that's kind of like a good, like, comfort movie. Like, I know that that's why I like it so much too. It's like, yeah, it's one of those things where you're never really disappointed by it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we got such a big difference in audience scores between IMDb and Rotten Tomatoes this time. Mm-hmm. 7.8 and the 92. And then the critics at 61 and 79. So you say that you can watch it over and over again and how much you love it. Where do you fall in if you were to actually give it a rating then?
I would give it like an 89.
Yeah?
Yeah. Okay. I think it's something that the topicalness of it and just the lighthearted make it something that's truly entertaining to watch. But again, yeah, like going over a deep analysis of it, like we are now, you realize how many plot holes and like weird things happen.
Oh yeah, there's very little substance.
Yeah.
What about you, Colin? Where does it fall for you on this watch?
Yeah, I would say, like, critically, I would give it a 40%. But yeah, if you add in the nostalgia factor, you, like, raise that by, like, 50%. So it ends up being around a 90 for me. Just because, yeah, when I really think about the movie, I'm like, this is not a masterpiece by any stretch of the imagination. It seems to be,
right? Yeah.
Very, very poorly written. Not a lot happens. It's one of those movies where I feel like there were so many other interesting things that could have been developed and told that weren't. Yeah. Like with Cameron, like basically all the ancillary characters, like Cameron, Sloan, Genie, like just even one or two scenes each to kind of tell me where they were coming from and what their life story is would have been nice.
Why is Genie so furious?
Why is Genie so mad and why does she turn on a dime? Like, she doesn't seem to care for Ferris at all.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden she just comes to his rescue. Sloane, she's like, I don't even understand what her thing is with Ferris.
He seems like
kind of a douche. Like, he doesn't seem like overly nice to her.
Yeah.
He just has a lot of charisma, maybe. I don't know. But at the same time, like Carly was saying in like that one review we read, it is very much a, oh, I don't know what to watch. Well, Ferris Bueller is a pretty good option if I scroll past it. Like, it's one of those movies, it's like a very good background movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, it's a good movie to just kind of put on while you're doing something else, and like, oh, you hit the key scenes and you laugh and it makes you feel good.
Yeah, I know I mentioned back in our Planes, Trains, and Automobiles episode with Ferris Bueller that it was one of those ones that when I worked my video store job, I could have playing during the day because it was somewhat appropriate and it was one that you don't get tired of. So great background movie is definitely, that's right on the nose there for me, is it always was a background movie. Yeah, it is interesting doing something like this where I am looking at it more critically and going, wait a minute. None of that makes any sense. Looking at the idea of maybe there is a supernatural quality of, oh, it is Cameron's figment of Cameron's imagination, does really make me look at it in a whole different light, which I think is kind of funny. But I also look at that list of the people that could have played Ferris Bueller, and I don't know if I would have liked anyone as much as Matthew Broderick. Because watching this movie, you realize what an unlikable character Ferris Bueller should be.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And he is so charming. Michael J. Fox might have been able to pull it off, but Matthew Broderick is so charming. And you know, with what you said about Sloane, you don't know what her deal is. I can get it because, you know, it would have been easy to win her over, I think, if you were Ferris Bueller being played by Matthew Broderick, you know? And it's funny because I can never see Matthew Broderick any other way because he's always just that lovable guy. You know, you look at Godzilla and something like that, it was such a weird character, but he's still just Ferris Bueller and he's just got this charm to him. So, you know, I feel sort of the same way that Colin does, and I also agree with that last review where it's kind of like, this is it's a flawed movie on this watch. I realize just how flawed it is, but yeah, I still love it. It's still a fun movie. It still brings me joy, and it's you know, yeah, it's just like, even though I've poked all these holes, am I never going to watch it again? Hell no, right? I'll be watching this again. So right on. Well, there we go. That is Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and that's our show for this week. Big huge thank you to our John Hughes fangirl, Carly Holm.
Yay! Thank you for having me.
A resident Hughes expert.
Yeah.
That's what we'll have to call you.
It's funny because the week that I watched this movie, I was reading Ready Player 2, and there's this whole John Hughes section of Ready Player 2, which is probably 4 or 5 chapters long that all take place in John Hughes universes. And I thought, well, it couldn't be more fitting that we had a John Hughes movie. Now, as the super fan of John Hughes, though, was there anything that I missed, Carly? Do you think we touched on everything?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Right on. Well, thank you for joining us, Carly. Next time we have another John Hughes movie, I'm sure we'll have you back again.
I feel like we still need to do Breakfast Club with Carly.
Yes, oh, I would love that. I would love nothing more. I'm always happy to be a guest, so whenever you'd like me, I would love to come back.
If you like that show, one thing you can do to really help us out on the business end is tell your friends, share our posts. Word of mouth is really important for a podcast trying to get noticed in the huge sea of shows out there. Every celebrity has a podcast. We're not celebrities. Tell people. Let people find our show. Or if you want to go above and beyond and help us and use science and the algorithms of Apple Podcasts and Stitcher and all those, go to whatever app it is you listen to your podcasts on and give us 5 stars. It doesn't matter what you say, but those 5 stars drive us up the charts and help us get noticed.
And be sure to check out our website, www.iusedtolikethisone.com. There you can find links to all of our social medias as well as our podcast episodes, so be sure to check them out. If you want to get in contact with us, you can reach us by email at iusedtolikethisone@gmail.com. Send us an email. Tell us what you used to like, and maybe just like Rebecca?
Rebecca H.
Rebecca H., you might find us reviewing your movie. Maybe you'll even be a guest. I don't know. We'll see.
Ooh.
To be determined.
And if you would like to be a producer of the show and donate to us, you can go to patreon.com/iusedtolikethisone. Become part of our Patreon community. Become part of our family. Help us be self-sustaining on this show. There are a few expenses that people aren't aware of that go into a podcast. You know, help us out. I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells, music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band, Carter in the Capitals, anywhere you listen to music. Thank you for listening. And join us next week when we take a look at another movie on I Used to Like This One.